Hey, all, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. I'm him, and introducing our friend Will Grigg from Pro Libertate. That's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and of course, he's the author of the book Liberty in Eclipse. Welcome back to the show, Will. How are you?
Scott, I'm doing well. It's always a real pleasure to be with you.
Very happy to have you here, and very important story that you've written up. Merrick Garland, we all know him, Obama's nominee to replace Antonin Scalia as Associate Justice on the Supreme Court. Richard W. Roberts, for some reason that name rings a bell from the headlines of the last couple of weeks here. And, of course, Kenneth Trenadue. So let's start with that. Who's Kenneth Trenadue? And then I guess when it becomes important, we'll get to the part about Richard Roberts here, Will.
Kenneth Trenadue, for lack of a more suitable description, is somebody who was murdered by the FBI in a case of mistaken identity of the most improbable kind. He had been a bank robber and served a term in prison, and upon being paroled, he apparently had become a changed man. He got married, and at the time of his death in August of 1995, at the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City, he was an expectant father. He had violated his parole because, for reasons that would make sense apparently only to this official, his parole officer decided to place a restriction on him forbidding him to consume alcohol. And he was not an alcoholic, Mr. Trenadue. He'd been a bank robber. His crime was a crime of violence and theft. It had nothing to do with intoxication or diminished capacity. And so he chafed under the restrictions placed upon him by a parole officer who is, for all intents and purposes, a slave owner when you're dealing with a parolee. The parole officer completely dominates your life. It's like being in prison, but you're not within a cell. And he went to Mexico shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing to visit his wife's family, and he was arrested at a border crossing because an arrest warrant had been put out for a parole violation. And he found himself taken to the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City and put into a cell. And a few days later, this is in August, once again, of 1995, his body was found hanging from a bed sheet. And his mother, Wilma, was contacted by telephone by the temporary warden who informed her that her son had committed suicide and that the body was going to be cremated in a couple of hours. Now, Wilma Trenadue, who was one of nature's strong people, genuinely commendable mother, had sufficient presence of mind to say, "You're not going to destroy the body of my son. You need to contact his wife and get her approval." The temporary warden wasn't aware that Kenneth Trenadue was married. She didn't know who this person was. And so the planned destruction of the corpse was put on hold while Wilma Trenadue and Kenneth's older brother, Jesse, traveled to Oklahoma. And they were given custody of his remains. And they removed several layers of ineptly applied makeup and discovered that his body was riddled with evidence of a severe beating. Contusions were found on his face, on his neck, his torso. His knuckles were scraped, and there were injuries on the soles of his feet of the sort you wouldn't associate with a hanging. And it became very clear quite quickly that he had been beaten to death. There was evidence that he had been garroted by zip cuffs, apparently. It was later discovered that the instrument used to choke him had been a pair of plastic zip cuffs. And then part of his scalp had been torn away. Now, this is something that wouldn't have happened if he just hanged himself in a fit of despondency. And he was an expectant father once again. He expected to be informed of the birth of his son in a couple of weeks. As he was investigating what happened to his brother, Jesse received a phone call from somebody attached to the prison who said that there had been an interrogation that had gone wrong and that his brother Kenneth had been beaten to death by the FBI. By this time, a lot of the pertinent physical evidence had been destroyed. Before the body had been surrendered to Jesse Trenadue and the mother, Wilma Trenadue, the cell had been sanitized. The walls had been scrubbed. The floor had been scrubbed. The bedding had been removed. The clothing had been removed. and taken into the possession of an FBI agent who would leave it in the trunk of his car until it putrefied and became useless for examination by the FBI's crime lab. This all happened within the course of several weeks. Over the course of the last 20-some-odd years, Jesse Tredidu, who's a trial attorney in Salt Lake City, Utah, has been devoting as much of his time as he can afford, bearing in mind he has to maintain a business as well, and there are certain vulnerabilities that attach to that because he has to be in good favor, good standing with the Bar Association and such like. But he has devoted as much of his time and energy as possible to trying to find out what happened to his brother and why he was killed. And he has developed a formidable body of evidence that he was mistaken for a man named Richard Lee Guthrie, who was his near twin in a lot of ways. They were of comparable age. They were the same size. They had similar builds. They were both slightly shorter than average build, average height, but very muscular. Brown hair, brown eyes, a mustache, although Richard Lee Guthrie, he was taken into the prison system, shaved his mustache. Each of them had a nearly identical dragon tattoo, and they'd both been bank robbers. The biggest difference is that Richard Lee Guthrie had attached to a group calling itself the Aryan Republican Army, which was a neo-Nazi group that would conduct bank robberies for the purpose of raising money for domestic terrorism. In the course of investigating that thread of what happened, the idea that Guthrie was in prison at the same time that Kenneth Tredidu was in prison, and that Tredidu had been mistaken for Guthrie, what Jesse Tredidu, the brother, discovered is that the Aryan Republican Army was connected to the Oklahoma City bombing. There were many people, many personalities who had been associated with that group, including apparently Tim McVeigh, who had been involved in the planning of the execution of the bombing. And some of the people attached to the ARA made very good matches with some of the others unknown referred to in the original Oklahoma City indictment. You recall that in addition to Timothy McVeigh, the indictment did mention others unknown, but that was dropped very quickly. And among the others unknown was a swarthy-looking, short, muscular, dark-haired man referred to as John Doe Number 2, who had been seen in the company of Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City on the morning of the bombing. And what Jesse Tredidu has been trying to find is videotaped evidence that has not been released by the FBI of the moments leading up to the blast, some of which apparently captured McVeigh in the company, in the presence of this John Doe Number 2. Now, it was suspected that Richard Lee Guthrie might have been John Doe Number 2, or at least he might have known some of the potential suspects who would meet that description. It's possible John Doe Number 2 is still at large. But Guthrie was in the same prison system, not in Oklahoma City, but he was in the federal prison system at the same time that Kenneth Tredidu was scooped up, apparently mistaken for Richard Lee Guthrie and taken to Oklahoma City and beaten to death. And within a few months, Guthrie was talking about how he intended to publish a memoir that would provide all kinds of blockbuster revelations about federal foreknowledge of the Oklahoma City bombing, the idea for perhaps that it had been a sting operation that gone awry. But he was found hanging in his prison cell just a few months later, in early 1996. So over the last 21 years, a little bit more than that, actually, roughly 21 years or so, Jesse Tredidu has been involved in a lengthy and very expensive and unbelievably frustrating legal struggle with the FBI, trying to find out what happened to the crucial video evidence that would be able to identify this man who was apparently mistaken for his brother, who was killed by the FBI. Now, it's important to recognize here that everything that was done in sanitizing this cell and destroying the evidence of what was a crime scene, everything that was done was a violation of federal policy, Bureau of Prisons policy, and Oklahoma state law. Medical examiners who had a chance to inspect the body concluded that this could not possibly have been a suicide. One of the chief investigators for the Oklahoma State Medical Examiner's Office, rather, had said in no uncertain terms this was an act of murder. And this is something that was not followed up on by the Bureau of Prisons. Within a day, they had simply certified that this was a suicide, and as far as they were concerned, that was the end of the whole question. Through his own persistence, Tredidu managed to create enough trouble with the help of some officials there in the state of Oklahoma that the Justice Department's criminal division conducted what they called an inquiry into the death of Kenneth Tredidu. And this lasted for roughly 2 years through late 1997. And after convening a thoroughly manipulated federal grand jury, the Justice Department pronounced that this would, that this matter had been closed, that this was a suicide. Kenneth Trenadue, despite the abundant evidence that he had been beaten to death, had managed somehow to hang himself in such a way that he had inflicted all these injuries on himself, and that closed the matter as far as they were concerned. Now, Jesse Trenadue, in October of 1997, wrote a very angry letter to the head at the time of the Justice Department's Criminal Division, recounting and documenting for the record conversations he had had in which he had been told in so many words, you just have to trust the government in this matter. And Jesse Trenadue outlined in the course of about four pages of text that was incandescent with rage, he'd outlined all the many reasons why this was an obvious cover-up of a matter that could not be dismissed as a suicide by any reasonable person. And he said that he had abundant reasons not to trust the Justice Department. There's no reason why you should trust the government generically, he said. The Constitution is based on the idea that the government is fundamentally untrustworthy. But specifically, you cannot trust the Justice Department, as Jesse's experience had demonstrated. Now, the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department at the time was a former federal prosecutor by the name of Richard W. Roberts. And about a year later, Richard W. Roberts was nominated by Bill Clinton to be on the district court for the District of Columbia, the U.S. District Court that covers the capital of the United States. Richard W. Roberts, just a couple of weeks ago, as you alluded to previously, Scott, was compelled to resign supposedly for health reasons after a lawsuit was filed in the state of Utah against him by a woman whom he had raped and molested while he was a federal prosecutor in the early 1980s. Now, Roberts admits that there was a sexual relationship with this woman. Her name was now Terry Mitchell. It was Terry Elrod at the time. He admits that there was a sexual relationship. At the time, he was 27, almost 28 years old. She was 16 when they began their supposed relationship. What she said in her lawsuit, and this is something that has been validated in substantive part by an investigation conducted through the Attorney General's office in Utah and also the House Oversight Committee. And the House Judiciary, or the Senate Judiciary Committee, have been conducting parallel investigations of this matter. They confirmed that this so-called relationship began when she was a 16-year-old witness to a racially motivated double murder in Salt Lake City, carried out, as it happens, by a white supremacist bank robber. I have no idea if there were any connections between his crimes in the 1970s and what was going on in the 1990s. That's something I'd very much like to investigate. I wanted to see other investigators look into that matter. But she had witnessed this double murder that was carried out in 1980, and she was being used as a witness in a federal civil rights trial that actually happened before the murder trial in the state of Utah. I would consider murder to be a much more important matter than civil rights violations, however serious they might be. You can't have a greater crime than murder. But the federal civil rights trial was conducted in early 1981. She was enticed back to Mr. Roberts' hotel on the pretext of going over her testimony as trial prep. And while she was in the hotel room, he forced himself upon her and then told her that she couldn't disclose what had happened because if this were to become public knowledge, he would be removed from the case, a mistrial would be declared, and the man who had murdered two of her friends in front of her and injured her, she was hit by shrapnel as a result of the sniper attack, that this man would be let free. And so he used the leverage, the threat that a murderer would be let loose as a way of compelling her to remain silent about the fact that he sexually exploited her. This is a 16-year-old girl, once again, for about 2 months during the course of the civil rights trial. That happened in 1981. In 2013, the murderer, the man who committed that murder, was put to death in Missouri, and that prompted Mr. Roberts to get back in touch with Terry Mitchell. She was able to arrange a phone call in which he disclosed and confirmed the sexual so-called relationship that they had had when she was 16. That began an investigation that led to his resignation a couple of weeks ago under the cloud of potential criminal prosecution or at least an investigation for judicial misconduct for something that he had done when he was a federal prosecutor. His supervisor, his direct supervisor in the federal court system was Merrick Garland, who's now the nominee to fill the seat that was made vacant by the death of Antonin Scalia. Now, their paths intersected during the Oklahoma City investigation because at the preliminary hearing for Timothy McVeigh in April of 1995, there was a defense attorney who mentioned the existence of one of the videotapes now being sought by Jesse Trenadue. There were several videotapes that were entered into evidence. There was one critical videotape that was taken by a surveillance camera on a neighboring apartment building that wasn't entered into evidence, but there were still photographs that were entered into evidence that showed, allegedly, Timothy McVeigh setting the bomb or otherwise conducting business as he was preparing to murder 168 people. Those photographs were entered, but the videotape itself was not entered. Now, the defense attorney wanted to know what happened to the videotape. At that point, Merrick Garland objected strenuously on two occasions. One of his objections was overruled. The second one was sustained. But as a result of those objections, the courtroom investigation into the question of this videotape was foreclosed for a matter of decades. And now Jesse Trenadue can't get a hold of that videotape. That's one of, I think, two or three critical videotapes, the existence of which has been confirmed as a matter of court record now, but that are being withheld from Jesse Trenadue, notwithstanding the fact that there are at least two existing court orders by Judge Clarence Wattups. He's a federal judge in Utah, that compel the FBI to provide all of the relevant video information to Jesse Trenadue. And there's an active case right now for contempt of court because the FBI continues to defy the court order to provide him with that material. But if you take a look, if you walk back the thread of this to April of 1995, the person who actually took the initiative in foreclosing the disclosure of that videotape, for whatever reason, was Merrick Garland, who at the time was a federal prosecutor in the Oklahoma City bombing case. So these paths intersect in the most peculiar and bizarre way possible. They intersect the paths of Merrick Garland, Richard Roberts, and Kenneth Trenadue in the matter of the Oklahoma City bombing. And I don't think that the Senate, assuming that the Senate actually has confirmation hearings about the Merrick Garland appointment, that's being caught up right now in the predictable partisan rancor and wrangling that goes on in Washington. But if there were a confirmation hearing, I rather doubt that they would be willing to look into that element of what's happened here, in spite of the fact that Utah Senator Orrin Hatch is very well aware of what happened with Kenneth Trenadue. He's very well aware that there was a cover-up perpetrated right from the beginning of that question back in August of 1995. I would like to see confirmation hearings to see if there's anybody in the Senate with sufficient dangling anatomy to bring up these questions, because these are questions that go right to the very heart of one of the most significant things to happen in the last 25 or 30 years, which was the Oklahoma City bombing. And in larger compass here, Scott, this is something you've discussed on your program on a number of occasions. What Trenadue has documented and examined to some depth is the existence of an off-the-shelf FBI infiltration program called PATCON. That's a portmanteau of Patriot Conspiracy. And it was a program through which the FBI, and as they had during the COINTELPRO program of the 1960s and 1970s, they infiltrated right-wing groups, so-called anti-government groups, seeding them with informants and provocateurs as a way of generating a steady series of what we now call Homeland Security theater operations to discredit certain movements on the fringes of American political dialogue and to generate convictions. And, of course, convictions are what the FBI produces. That's the supposed benefit provided by this government agency. But Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City bombing was carried out, I'm satisfied, and so as Jesse tried to do on the basis of the evidence, was carried out as a PATCON initiative. And it was a sting operation, I'm willing to bet. Some people think that it was a case of the federal government actually blowing up this building as a matter of malign intent. I think that this is a case where ineptitude actually is the larger and more significant element than malignity. I mean, they obviously coexist. In this case, I think they were trying to be just a little bit too clever. They were trying to finesse something that wasn't susceptible to finesse, and they blew the sting operation, and 168 people died, because they were messing around with something that is intended to shape the public mind rather than to protect the public against crime. And so for the last 20-some-odd years now, we've seen an ongoing effort in order to protect the people who are implicated in this world-historic crime in Oklahoma City. And I don't think that there'd be much of a constituency among the type of people you'd find in the Senate for a candid examination of this. But, oh, dear God, I wish there would be. This is something I would desperately like to see.
All right, a couple of notes here. First of all, there's an article from 2010 in the New York Times by Charlie Savage, which is a profile of Merrick Garland, in which Oklahoma City is sort of, you know, as Bill Clinton said, saved his presidency. For Merrick Garland, this is the big notch in his career. This is what made his career and made him famous within the Justice Department. He was the head of the criminal division at the time, I believe you said, correct?
Well, Richard Roberts was the head of the criminal division, if I remember correctly. Well, by 1997, Richard Roberts was.
What exactly, I don't have it in front of me, but do you remember what was Garland's job at the Justice Department at the time of the Oklahoma bombing?
Exactly. He was just the U.S. attorney at the time.
The U.S. attorney. All right. Well,
yeah, he was the U.S. attorney assigned to head the prosecution of Timothy McVeigh. That did make his career.
I guess I had it mistaken that he was, well, or I don't know. Damn, I'm sorry, man. I wish I had reread that New York Times piece before I brought it up here. But the way they made it sound, I thought, was that he came down from the Justice Department and took control of the investigation in a way that, you know, in their spin, made him a real hero. And he was taking credit for intervening on a lower level of decision making than someone in his position would normally do. In other words, he wasn't delegating. He went down there and took charge, which, of course, from your and my point of view, is not a claim of credit, but is a claim of responsibility for a massive cover-up. And it belies any notion of deniability on his part that, you know, maybe Bob Ricks and them screwed up something, but I never heard of that. You know what I mean? Since he really is claiming a real hands-on role here.
Yeah, he was the guy dispatched from Washington, D.C., from the criminal division of the Justice Department, to have direct hands-on control and supervision of the prosecutions in Oklahoma City. And that, of course, was the most important case for a number of years, at least for the 2 years between 95 and 97. There were probably, I would assume, probably something on the order of 60 to 75% of the FBI's personnel tasked to what they call the Oak Bomb investigation. And of that group, I would say probably a quarter of them were actually involved in trying to solve the case, and the rest of them were involved in trying to make sure that the case wasn't solved to the point where we know everything germane regarding the others unknown, particularly that were involved in that terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. Because that question implicated the people that the DOJ was trying to protect who had been orchestrating this thing. And, yeah, he was dispatched from Washington, D.C. as their official emissary. He did make his career on the basis of the prosecution of the Oklahoma City bombing. There's no reason to expect that he would be ignorant of the existence of these videotapes and other evidence that would lead an actual inquiry away from the direction that they were trying to channel it, which was the idea that Timothy McVeigh, bore almost exclusive responsibility for this. That he was not the lone gunman, but effectively the lone bomber. And they really wanted to make sure that the argument against the so-called anti-government right would be made by inference and insinuation rather than exposing the material that would have shown that the FBI had infiltrated the worst elements of that group and they were actively promoting criminal misconduct. By way of underscoring how cynical this was, over the last 10 years or so, the last 10 to 15 years post 9/11, we've seen the FBI target all these marginalized Muslim males for these sting operations where somebody will show up, rile up a targeted Muslim individual by showing him video recordings of U.S. military operations that result in villages being wiped out and women and children being killed, and then point him in the direction of doing something stupid with a dummy bomb. You know, as you'd say, have him say something stupid into a microphone, then give him a dummy bomb and set him out to bomb some targeted location. And then at the last minute, the FBI swoops in, they take control of the supposed bomb, which is a dud. It couldn't have actually done any damage. And then they arrest him, and then the headline triumphantly talks about the FBI interdicting yet another terrorist plot. They were doing the same thing through PatCon back in the 1990s, probably in the 1980s, with right-wing groups, white supremacist groups, and people of that ilk. The Aryan Republican Army, as they carried out their bank robberies, were using dummy bombs provided to them by the FBI. So they were stealing from banks. They're going in and taking these huge hauls from banks and using them to fund other operations that were being directed by PatCon. And what clearly happened here on the basis of what we've been able to learn is that part of what happened at Oklahoma City was funded in this way. And that if that link had been allowed to be, had been left undestroyed by Merrick Garland and his investigation, if he'd not broken that link, the chain would have led right back to PatCon, right back to all these proprietary operations being run by the FBI. He had to have known about this. We're probably not going to have the Judiciary Committee investigate this, but that would be the most important thing they could do, which means, of course, it's the first thing they'll try to avoid.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. All right. Now, I want to mention here, and I know I'm kind of beating a dead horse, and it's not even the most important point in this book, but really, Will, I'm on a mission to memorize this page number. I keep messing it up and getting it in the wrong order. It's 328, Scott Horton. 328. Oklahoma City, Why? What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters by Gumbel and Charles. And on page 328, Larry Mackey, who was one of the prosecutors, one of the federal prosecutors under the U.S. attorney there, he admits in a very kind of convoluted way, we may have discussed this before, he says, he's speaking for all of his colleagues. When asked if, you know, the rest of the prosecutors working the case felt the same as him, he said, if you had said to us, anyone in this room 100% confident that McVeigh was alone, raise your hand, we would have all kept our hands in our laps. Which is just, it's all full of these weird double negatives and newspeak and,
exactly,
and avoiding of responsibility. But what he's saying here is, if you asked us, did we let the rest of the perpetrators go, we would all have to raise our hands. That we all know that we really didn't, you know, go all the way through this investigation, all the way to the end. And now, when pressed on the point in the book, their excuse, such as it is, their explanation is they didn't want to jeopardize the death penalty case against McVeigh. And that by bringing up Andre Strassmeyer and bringing up Michael Brescia and bringing up Richard Lee Guthrie, that this would mean reasonable doubt that maybe McVeigh was just a stupid idiot driving the truck, but, you know, somebody else was the mastermind, and then he might get away with only life and not death. And so that was their excuse. And, of course, I'm with you. Obviously, you have all kinds of flip states witnesses and undercover informants and prior knowledge that you could fill a book with on the part of the ATF and the FBI before this thing happened. And so anyway, I just want, I like pointing that out, that they will concede at least about what, 3/4 or maybe 7/8 of what you're saying here, Will Grigg. They just kind of, they don't want to admit that it's for the reasons that you say, but they concede that, the others got away.
Well, consider this, Scott. The rationale that you're describing here is the macrocosmic application of the method used by Roberts to ensure the silence of his rape victim. If we were to tell the full truth, then the system that we serve is going to let these dangerous people get away. Now, think about that for just a second. It wouldn't make sense to say that you should focus on making sure that Timothy McVeigh dies, and in doing so, compromise a process that would protect the public against the people who were his associates. That's the priority here for the so-called Justice Department. Yeah, we have to make sure this guy dies. Why is it so important to make sure this guy dies, as opposed to sending him to prison for the rest of his life? If you send him to prison for the rest of his life, and in doing so, you find out who the other people were, that's to the larger benefit of the public. But, of course, that would injure the interests of the power elite, because the people that whose identities would be revealed would compromise people within the Justice Department and within the executive branch. Protecting those people at the expense of the public is a priority of the Justice Department.
And, of course, they were only prosecuting him for killing any feds that died there that day, any federal police. Any other civilians, they could still be prosecuted in state court, no problem. And the people of Oklahoma would have been happy to have lynched McVeigh.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a second. There's no way on earth that he would have avoided the death penalty if he would have been tried, first of all, as he should have been, for the crime committed in the jurisdiction of Oklahoma under its murder statutes. Under the constitutional scheme, that's what should be focused on first. But the first and most urgent priority was to make sure that Timothy McVeigh was punished for his crimes against the Imperium. It's the same sort of thing that led Richard Roberts to Salt Lake City back in 1980 and 1981. For whatever reason, the federal government wanted to get involved in a federal civil rights prosecution of a guy who'd gunned down two black joggers just because he didn't like seeing black joggers in the company of white women. That's something that needs to be looked at here. How long has PATCON been going on? Okay, was Joseph Paul Franklin, the murderer who was involved in the incident in 1980, was he involved in some ancestor of PATCON? That's something that really should be looked at as well.
You know, I have that book that J.D. Cash told me to get years ago. It's by, I bet you've probably already read it, but it's all about the original Knights of whatever, Nazis and constitutional committees, self-appointed, you know, right-wing kooks, far, far, far right-wing kooks back in the 70s and 80s there, the original generation of McVeigh and his buddies. Man, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the book.
Are you talking about the novel?
No, here, say something interesting for a second and I'm going to find it. I have it here.
That I find most compelling, once again, about what happened here with the cover-up of McVeigh's Others Unknown is the fact that you had this Richard Roberts using that same torqued, inverted logic to serve his own personal interests, whereas it was used in the Oklahoma City bombing case for the purpose of protecting the institutional interests of the so-called Justice Department and the FBI.
Yeah. Oh, it was Committee of the States. That's the book by Cherry Seymour. Does that sound familiar?
That does sound familiar. I've not read that, as it happens. It sounds like a fascinating book.
J.D. Cash told me to read that, and I believe it was on the tangent of the original plot to bomb the Oklahoma City building.
Yeah.
One of the same guys who was involved in that, Snell, was executed the day of the actual Oklahoma bombing, and this was a book about him and all his buddies, I think.
But we do know, if we want to talk about the pedigree of PATCON. I've mentioned COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO, of course, targeted the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, and Students for Democratic Society, and other groups that are placed, for whatever reason, on the left of the spectrum, often arbitrarily. I think AIM is a little bit more of a little bit more difficult to taxonomize than that. But they also focused on the Ku Klux Klan. They focused on the American Nazi Movement. There's pretty good evidence that George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the largest Nazi group, was on the FBI payroll. It was a matter of well-established folk wisdom back in the 1960s that if you had six Klansmen in a room, at least four of them were going to be working for the FBI. We know that the largest Klan group that was headed by Sam Bowers was infiltrated by Delmar Dennis, who had been hired as an informant by the FBI. Delmar Dennis had been a chapter leader for the John Birch Society, who was recruited into the KKK and rapidly, and to his credit, very quickly became disillusioned with it. He'd been nurtured on the lore of the KKK as the defenders of fair Southern womanhood, and he joined the Klan, and the first thing he saw were a group of people whose hands were bloody because they'd gone to a black church and beaten up a bunch of people at worship. Delmar Dennis was a preacher. He didn't think that the Klan represented that kind of violence. When he discovered that it did, he contacted the FBI. They said, "Well, stay in the FBI, stay in the Klan for a while. We could be useful to have an informant in the Klan." And Dennis, from what I've been able to read, did some good work in terms of actually exposing evidence of crimes, such as the Mississippi. Everybody knows about the Mississippi Burning Murders case. He was the chief witness in the eventual civil rights trial in the 1990s. Of the perpetrator of the Mississippi, that was the 1960s. He was involved in the Medgar Evers case, the civil rights trial of the 1990s. But the point I'm making here is that the FBI had obviously infiltrated many of the groups that eventually coalesced into groups like the Committee of the States, the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord, and the others that were involved in sort of as a sort of a farm team for the groups that were organized by the FBI through Bataan in the 1990s.
Well, and so what's so interesting about that, right, is that anybody would actually probably prefer that. If I could think of an excuse for the existence of the FBI, it would be to keep the Klan on a leash, right? But I don't want them making them worse.
Yeah.
Will, there's the point is to neutralize them, not build up and blow up a building full of little babies.
Yeah, exactly. They treat these people as assets rather than as enemies. And they're interested primarily in institutional self-preservation and perpetuating their mission. This falls into the category of what you and I have heard referred to as the self-licking ice cream cone. If you didn't have the FBI involved in funding groups of this sort, Scott, I'm convinced they would no longer exist. They weren't involved in nurturing in various ways, both direct and indirect. You probably wouldn't have a lot of these right-wing neo-Nazi groups, or what are called right-wing neo-Nazi groups and white ethnic groups, ethno-nationalist groups. They've been doing this for decades now. And they do the same thing with some groups on the left, no doubt. But they've over the last 20 years or so, they've moved from doing this with the ethno-nationalist or white supremacist groups, they've started doing the same thing with Muslim groups now when the focus of demand shifted after September 11. That became a growth stock during the first decade of this century, and the same thing's going on now. Although there's evidence right now that they've redirected their attention once again at what's called the political right, particularly with respect to land rights disputes out here in the western United States. But this is one of the things that government does. Government creates the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory. You know, the proverbial firefighter who moonlights as an arsonist.
Right. Well, yeah, and they do such a great job of, you know, tarring the entire right with the very worst of them. But it's interesting how, and, you know, not that I'm a big fan of the right, but still, they ain't a bunch of Nazis. Mm-hmm. They're conservatives, and that's bad enough, but let's not lie about them, you know?
Yeah.
Or the right populists, they're populists, but still that doesn't necessarily make them Nazis, you know? But
exactly.
What's funny is here is, as you mentioned before, earlier in the interview here, when it came to the Oklahoma bombing, they accused, only in the most general way they kind of connected the right to it. And what's interesting about that is they skipped right over the Nazis and right over people who were the actual white supremacists who did this stuff, the Aryan Republican Army, who were McVeigh's friends who helped them and their ideological cousins, etc. And instead they went after every militia group in America, which at that time included a lot of, let's be honest, regular folks who were upset about Waco and just want to make sure the message was clear that we all have each other's phone numbers and rifles, and we're not going to let you do anything like that around here. But they weren't any offensive threat, and they weren't white supremacists. They didn't hate blacks and Jews, etc., like that.
Yeah.
The vast majority of them. I remember Bill Curtis on A&E did an investigative report about a bunch of the different militias, and he's like, I'm impressed by these guys. They're fine, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But meanwhile, according to TV, the militia did it. The militia did it. The Branch Davidians did it. They went forward in time and blew up Oklahoma, and that justified what we did to them. And everybody did it except the actual Nazis, the Hitler-loving, bank-robbing Nazis that actually did the bombing. And they suppressed that part of the narrative so much in exploiting and blaming everyone from Rush Limbaugh and all the way to the right from there for it. You know, basically every white gun owner in America or whatever supposedly was responsible. Then on the day of the execution, they literally are on CBS Morning News, Today Show or whatever it is saying, well, isn't that interesting that his head is shaved all the way to the skin, huh?
Yeah.
And I wonder if he means anything by that. Yeah, we didn't actually bother to cover that angle on this mass murder for the last 7 years. And so now, what a mystery. Is that a thing with the Michigan militia? Do they all shave their head directly to the skin? No. You know?
Well, the really interesting point in this discussion, Scott, is that Timothy McVeigh showed up for at least a couple of meetings of militia groups and he was thrown out. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. And if he's the sort of a person who would either trigger the moral gag reflex of militia activists or provoke them to doing a background check to discovering that he was the sort of person whose company they wouldn't enjoy, there's obviously no excuse for the FBI not to be able to have similar discernment in dealing with people such as those who were at Elohim City there, which was a white supremacist commune in Oklahoma State that was a staging area and organizing nexus for a lot of the people who were involved in the bombing. And it was completely overrun with federal informants, including one, Carol Howe, who was with the ATF, who was actually there trying to prevent crimes. You know, the one person who was there about whom we can say with something approaching moral certainty that she was actually trying to prevent the Oklahoma City bombing. She was the one, Carol Howe, who took that role, and they burned her. They exposed her identity and then sent her back, knowing that she would probably get killed once she had been revealed to be a federal asset. You know, the people who actually do this sort of work as cooperating informants or as undercover operatives who are actually trying to prevent crimes of this sort, they're the ones who end up being left out there to be taken down, killed, or they're the ones who end up being prosecuted for things they didn't actually do, as opposed to the ones who are there for the purpose of incitement or the purpose of orchestrating crimes for which the FBI will eventually take some credit, either by interdicting their own plot or by capturing somebody after people have been killed, which is what happened at Oklahoma City. I mean, it seems to be pretty clear that the FBI had set up the scenario in Oklahoma City that they were going to prevent this horrible thing from happening, mm-hmm. thereby creating this huge wave of revulsion against anybody who criticized the ATF and the FBI. The ATF, of course, had offices there at the Murrah building. The ATF offices in the Murrah building had been involved in the Holocaust in Mount Carmel in 1993. All kinds of propaganda benefit would have accrued from preventing the bombing of that building. But apparently what happened is that the bombing went forward, and then they had to improvise. They had to call an audible, and they've been running that play now since April of 1995. And a part of that resulted in the murder of Kenneth Trenadue, and it happens that his brother is a singularly tenacious and capable attorney who's not going to let this go. And he found perhaps the one honest judge in the entire U.S. court system there, Clarence Wadiff, right. who's looking at this stuff, and he's handed out a series of rulings at the expense of the FBI. And I think sometime this year he's going to hit them with a huge contempt judgment. And at that point, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to add to the existing record here showing that the FBI has lied at every step of this process.
All right. Now, I want to dumb that down just a little, not as dumb as I did before with the death penalty excuse. That was their excuse, and I hope I made it clear that I didn't really believe it. But it's worth bringing up because that's the only context in which they'll admit that, yeah, they let others go. Which yeah. is pretty big. But I want to dumb down what you say there and your metaphor with the entrapment cases of the Muslims. And I'm not saying I doubt you because I think I completely agree with you about that. And I think Andre Carl Strassmeyer is probably the key to that as a mm-hmm. guy who really was a fake Nazi, who was a yeah. cop, who was there to set these guys up. However, there's enough doubt there just because of my ignorance, okay? I'm not trying to debunk anyone else on this issue necessarily or anything like that. But I want to give you a little bit dumber model than that, which I think fits and makes them only 0.001% less guilty. And that would be more like the first World Trade Center attack. Where,
yeah.
as far as I know, Will, and again, I'm not trying to debunk anyone who really does know better than me necessarily on this. I'm going to say my best evidence on this is that these guys, Abu Alim, I mean, if you read Peter Lance, is the best on this in the world, by the way. You read Abu Alim and all these guys, they wanted to blow up this building. And they recruited a guy named Salem to build the bomb who went straight to the FBI and mm-hmm. said, glory day, I've been recruited to build the bomb in this plot, and isn't that great, and let's do it. They kept him as an informant. I know I'm not teaching you anything, but I'm trying to get through this quick for the analogy for yeah. the audience here. They kept him inside the plot for a while, but then they basically burned him, as Carol Howe was burned. And yes. in this case, they wanted him to wear a wire, as Carson Dunbar was the FBI supervisor, who over his agents' dead bodies, by the way, insisted on he has to wear a wire and no, we won't give him a raise from $300 to $500 a week while he's sleeping on the floor of the mosque with these guys as they're planning this attack. So he told the guys, man, I got to get out of here. I think the FBI is on my tail, so I'm going to leave town and take the heat off of you guys. Bye. He left the plot, and then in came Ramzi Youssef, who built the bomb that killed six people and that very well could have toppled, very well could have toppled one tower into the other tower at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, killing 20,000 something people. That would have been 9/11 just times. Can you imagine? On the day before the Waco raid, or 2 days before the Waco raid, if that had happened. That is, again, a huge attack, not exactly a sting, but sort of a sting, right? They didn't completely invent it like these ridiculous entrapment cases nowadays, but they, boy, if they had done their work, they sure could have stopped it, and they didn't. And I think that, you know, I'm not, I guess, willing 100% to concede that this must have been Strassmeyer's idea and not McVeigh's idea to do this in the first place. And maybe they just could have really, really, really could have stopped it, but didn't.
Well, they could have attached themselves to an existing plot.
That's what I'm trying
to
say.
Yeah, and then act and assume that they could somehow put enough body English on it to avert the worst outcome at the last possible second. And in the case of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, if Mohammed Salameh hadn't been such a world historic idiot, if he had followed his directions exactly and placed the Ryder truck in his history, that's an interesting little point of commonality here with the Oklahoma City bombing. The Ryder truck involvement here. If he had placed the Ryder truck against the structural support column that he'd been told to, rather than a different one, then you very well could have had the domino effect that would have brought down those towers simultaneously and killed probably tens of thousands of people. And the only reason why you had this be a damp squib rather than a stick of dynamite, so to speak, in terms of the order of magnitudes in the actual event, was the stupidity of Mohammed Salameh. That's the one thing that actually saved tens of thousands of people in Manhattan on that day in January of 1993. The FBI, as you pointed out, had detailed and specific knowledge of what was going on. They knew where the bombs were being mixed. They knew the composition of the bombs. They knew the key players. There was a fellow by the name of Ali Muhammad, who was listed as an unindicted co-conspirator in the January 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And I think it was about 6 months later that FBI agents arrested people from the same cell who were fixing another bomb, another fertilizer and diesel fuel bomb. And this Ali Muhammad fellow, as it turns out, was somebody who had deep connections to U.S. military intelligence. And so you've got this consistent thread here where the FBI puts together these little groups and then sets up these dramatic sting operations. And in the course of doing so, they get people killed. There could have been, as we mentioned, tens of thousands of people were killed in Manhattan in 1993 in the first World Trade Center bombing if it hadn't been for the stupidity of Mohammed Salameh, perhaps the providential stupidity of him. And a couple of years later at Oklahoma City, they were running the same scenario when people did die. Scores of people died in that bombing. And so when we're taking a look at the long-term cover-up here, that Jesse Trenadue has been investigating now since 1995, there are people in positions of trust in the United States government who are deeply implicated either in arranging or orchestrating these sting operations that became huge terrorist attacks or in abetting the cover-up thereof. And Merrick Garland is up to his waist, at least, in all of this ugliness. And it would be a tremendous service to what remains of our republic if the Senate were to investigate this matter in the course of considering whether to confirm him to a position on the U.S. Supreme Court. It would be a terrible outcome for him to end up on the Supreme Court. So if you end up with the Senate deciding, because of Republican obstructionism, that they're not going to consider the nomination, that would be useful. But I think a greater service would be performed if they were to hold those hearings and ask these questions. And I don't think anybody there would be interested in doing so, alas.
Well, as you well know, Will, that would be the first time the Senate ever held hearings on the Oklahoma City bombing.
Exactly.
They For some reason, that I just can't figure out. All right,
they do not want to broach the issue.
I've kept you way extra time here, but I sure am glad I did, and I know that every single one of the listeners will be glad as well. So thank you so much for coming back on the show and talking about this very important subject with us, Will.
Thank you so much, Scott.
All right, y'all, that is the heroic Will Grigg. He's the author of Liberty in Eclipse. He writes at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. That's pro libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And This article here, let me tell you, its title is Merrick Garland, Richard W. Roberts, and the Kenneth Trenadue Murder. The Deep State Takes Care of Its Own. And as you can tell, you just heard him. The article's written with just as much substance and style as well. And one more thing I want to mention here, because people ask me, what's a good documentary on Oklahoma City? And the only one I know is A Speech by Jesse Trenadue. I don't like any of the other ones. Talking Stick TV, Jesse Trenadue, Death, Lies, and Revenge in Federal Custody. That is the best thing for you to watch there if you want a YouTube version here. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. Subscribe, scotthorton.org. You can subscribe to the full show or the interview only feed. And I'll be doing some of my own stuff on the full show feed there. So subscribe to them both. Thanks. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.